This is Tom Shrewsbury with Reflections for the Covenant Network. Have you ever wondered just how many saints there are? Oh, that question probably is as easy to answer as how many stars there are in the sky. We can count a pretty impressive number of our saints just by thumbing through the many volumes of Butler's Lives of the Saints, which gives us a thumbnail sketch of various saints for just about every day of the year. But even with all of Butler's expertise, we don't even come close to the numbers of canonized saints. I believe there are many saints who are actually living among us, and we may or may not be aware of their particular sanctity, whether they be a religious or simply a lay person. If we look up the definition of a saint in the dictionary, we'll see several different criteria for being a saint. One of the simpler examples is, and I quote, "a person who lives a holy life, according to the will of God." I added that last part. Now, Mother Angelica, when she was on TV in the early days of EWTN, would constantly remind us that we are all called to be saints. But how many of us really take that to heart? Well, it may surprise you, particularly in today's world, but there are many people making an effort to do just that. But you see, that doesn't make the evening news, and it often goes unnoticed, except by God, and perhaps that's all that matters. And in His eyes, that person is a saint. Sainthood doesn't always come with blaring trumpets and great fanfare, but for a few of those very special people, they have been given special gifts or charisms that light up the darkness for many of us. You see, it's not always in the great public accomplishments that we've been given the gifts to serve God, but often in the quiet solitude of our own personal relationship with Him. Today, I'd like to tell you the story of just such a person, a young woman who, by today's standards, was only on this earth for a fairly short time, and while she did not move mountains and is probably almost unknown to most of us today, in her own quiet way, by the way she lived her life, she certainly left us a roadmap to heaven. Anna Maria Redi came into this world on the 15th of July, way back in 1747, and she was the second of 13 children born to Ignatius and Camille Redi. And while the family had close ties to nobility, they were not considered to be among the wealthy of Tuscany in that part of Italy. And since her mother was not too robust, the responsibility for supervising the behavior of her siblings fell to Anna Maria, who, as defined by her father, was not above spanking them for their misbehaving. Though she was a severe taskmaster in supervising the behavior of the children, Anna Maria's father could see that even at the age of 5, she had an understanding of who God was and an interest to fill her with a desire to please Him in all of her activities from the time she asked her parents this question, "Who is God?" Well, how does one explain God to a 5-year-old? Perhaps each person she asked tried too hard to explain Him, and it seemed to cause her much concern, until one day her mother explained very simply that God was love. Well, that did it. Sometimes the simplest answer is the best. In any case, that was the perfect answer for Anna Maria, who immediately asked an even more intelligent question for a 5-year-old. She asked, "What can I do to please Him?" Well, Fortunately, Anna Maria's family provided a wonderful example for her, and perhaps for us too. They not only had a great belief in their faith, but they practiced their faith as examples to their children, not only piously attending Mass, but also with family prayer, and the way they lived their daily lives. Perhaps it was only natural that Anna Maria would soon create her own small altar in her room, and she would spend more and more time quietly praying to this God of love with whom she was finding so attractive. Her younger brothers and sisters would frequently interrupt her wanting to play, and she would bribe them with prayer cards and so forth to leave her alone so she could speak to God on her own terms and build a closer relationship with him. Now, we have to remember that she was still a child, not even approaching her teens. While the family was comfortable, to say the least, the children were not raised to spend the time frivolously playing around. They were taught that they had chores to do and responsibilities to achieve. Life was not to be simply lived, but there was work that must be done and, more importantly, achievements to be made. Well, the parents, while loving, insisted that everyone had a job to do and a responsibility to achieve. In other words, there was no free ride. In Anna Maria's time, it was customary for the children to make their first confession several years before receiving their first Holy Communion. So, at the age of 7, Anna Maria encountered the confessional, which had a profound effect on the child, seeming to make God even closer to her. In later years, much later, her father would relate a conversation he had with his daughter. On their way home from church, in which she questioned all the wonderful things God had given us, and all that we can say to him at that time is, "Have patience with me because of our insecurities and because of our little activities that would offend him." And then she would go on to question why God gave us this gift to obtain pardon for our offenses to him, and yet how often we refuse to pardon someone else who has done something to us, or by simply bearing a grudge against them and not forgiving them also. Pretty deep thoughts for a 7-year-old. Her father would later relate that after that conversation, he was certain that God was calling her for something special, and he was so right. So, from that time on, he nurtured her love for God and introduced her to devotions to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, which would ultimately become a cornerstone of her spiritual life. One of the great lessons there for us was how we can have a positive effect on the lives of our children. How often do we reinforce their relationship with Almighty God? Or do we do it at all? Well, in this case, it is ironic that in attempting to bring Anna Maria closer to God, her father was actually succeeding, but that it would also one day take her away from him forever. Her father, that is, at least in this life, but that was still in the future. While this was a time in history when education was more targeted to the males of the family, Ignatius was intent on a better education for not just Anna Maria, but for the other daughters of the family as well. And while this would be a serious drain on the family's finances, even to the point of sacrifice, he felt that it was well worth the effort. And so when Anna Maria was just 9 years old, she was sent to St. Apollonia's boarding school in Florence, which was recognized for their simplicity as well as their stringent austerity, and surprisingly, even at such an early age, that appealed to Anna Maria, because she felt that this would give her a greater opportunity to serve God in a pure way without the bells and whistles of distraction. Many of the classes were very difficult for her, particularly those of Latin as well as mathematics, but she was very happy at St. Apollonia's and was viewed by the nuns as a pleasant and content young girl. Well, to the casual observer, Anna Maria was a typical young girl, very much like any other at the school, which was exactly what she had wanted. What was not seen, however, was her silent efforts in spiritual development that would bring her closer to a personal relationship with God. To her, this was of primary importance and not something to be seen or shared by others. It was to be her personal and private relationship with Almighty God. So, in retrospect, one can see that it was very important for her to lay the foundation for the perfection necessary for that special closeness she sought in serving God on His terms. By the age of 10, Anna Maria was well on her way to a well-balanced spiritual life that, to the casual observer, would probably not appear much different than any of the other younger girls, because she made every effort to appear no different. I think it critical to mention that the true description of her spiritual life was only put together after her death by an impartial combination of testimonies of family, nuns, priests, spiritual advisors, and of course her family, and particularly her father. She always exercised the most diligent efforts to conceal her deep spirituality. That was to be between her and God alone, but it was only after her death that the true depth of the spirituality she lived was actually recognized and verified. She was allowed to make her first Holy Communion at the age of 10, which at that time was a younger age than most of the other first communicants, and this was because, although she tried to hide her piety, the nuns who were her teachers as well as her observers recognized her devout attitude of prayer, and so she made her first communion on the Feast of the Assumption, just 1 month after her 10th birthday. After receiving the sacred host, her sanctity intensified, and it was her intention to live an even more holy life than she had experienced before, and yet she wanted that to be shared only with God. She felt a compulsion to lead what would appear to be a normally religious life to any observer while increasing her own personal devotions and sacrifices. She was even concerned to share the intensity of her devotions with her confessor for fear that he might think her presumptuous or possibly even seeking some recognition. However, there was one person with whom she felt she would be comfortable in sharing her feelings, the person to whom she had first confided her love of God and who first guided her, and that was her father, Ignatius. For 5 whole years, she would share her feelings and spirituality with her father, mainly through letters, and he would respond with encouragement and love because he knew firsthand the depth of her real spirituality. These communications would last until she met Father Peter Pellegrini at a retreat, who also recognized in her something very special to God. From that time forward, Father Pellegrini became her true spiritual advisor, and fearful that her correspondence with her father might appear too spiritually presumptuous, she requested her father to burn all of her letters, which he did. Father Pellegrini had to be inspired by Anna Maria's piety and was certain that God had special designs for her in the religious life, and he provided her with beautiful readings and materials to assist her in her spiritual growth while she would be appearing to all the world as just another ordinary little girl. She was now 16 years old, and the time had come for her to make some life-changing decisions. It was time for her to leave St. Apollonia. But where would she go, and what would she do? Of course, she recognized her calling to be a religious, but the question was, where? Oh, she loved and respected the Benedictine nuns who had been her teachers and role models there, but there was a nagging doubt that troubled her. She would put her trust in God, and he would show her the way. And show her he did. A young girl by the name of Cecilia Albergodi, whom she knew was going to enter the Carmel convent, had stopped by to say goodbye to her friends at St. Apollonia, and as she was leaving, the girl briefly grasped Anna Maria's hand, and not saying a word, gave her a knowing look, and their eyes met for just a brief moment, and then she was gone. But something was stirring in the soul of Anna Maria, and she headed back to her room. One could only imagine a strange feeling seemed to encompass her, and it was as if someone was actually speaking to her. The words were that clear. "I am Teresa of Jesus, and I want you among my daughters." That's what she heard. Of course, we know her as St. Teresa of Avila. Now, Anna Maria was confused. She hurried to the chapel, and as she knelt, she heard the words again, the very same words. "I am Teresa of Jesus, and I want you among my daughters." Well, Anna Maria left St. Apollonia's as planned, and after a short visit at home, she completed her application for the Carmel convent and entered Carmel on the 1st of September in 1764. She was just barely 17 years old as she took the name Teresa Margaret of the Heart of Jesus. As she entered the community of 13 professed nuns and 2 novices, Anna Maria, hereafter referred to as Teresa Margaret of the Heart of Jesus, felt unworthy to be among such holy women. She was welcomed by the nuns, who quickly recognized her spirituality and good humor, and her time of postulancy lasted about 4 months when she was unanimously accepted by the nuns, who considered her a gift and a true daughter of St. Teresa. As was the custom, novices were usually assigned to the tasks of housekeeping and the minor responsibilities of the convent. Margaret shared in these duties, but she also started assisting in the care of those sisters who were ill. It should be noted that among the 13 nuns in the convent, 9 were elderly and consequently in poor health, needing extra or special care. Well, naturally, Margaret was always available to assist in any way whenever needed, and it was not uncommon for her to move into the room of a seriously ill nun to provide whatever extra needed care she might require above and beyond what was expected of her. Her desire was to offer herself and her sacrifices completely as an offering to God. It was not unusual for her to practice severe penances, such as sleeping on the floor, leaving her window closed in the summer, anything she could do to unite herself with the sufferings of Christ. And yet she was always determined to present a smiling appearance, no matter how poorly or sickly she felt inside. She felt that God would be found when God alone was to be sought. And to reach that end, she made the following resolution, and I quote, "I propose to have no other purpose in all my activities, either interior or exterior, than the motive of love alone, by constantly asking myself, do I love God? If I should notice any obstacle to pure love, I shall take myself in hand and recall that I must seek to return my love for His love. End of quote. Well, a year after receiving her habit, Teresa Margaret was to be professed, but a previous abscess that had caused her suffering before reappeared on her knee, and she was concerned that this was a sign that she did not have a vocation. Well, so with humility, she brought her question before God Himself, asking if it were a sign that she should not be professed, God was to let her know. Well, he was very quick to answer, and the abscess disappeared almost immediately. In the brief 4 years after her profession as a nun, there was no job too lowly for her or any task too repulsive. And during these few years, there were stories of what might be called remarkable healings, not necessarily miraculous, but healings nonetheless, and strange and wonderful things seemed to follow her. She took as her motto, always receive with equal contentment from God's hand, either consolations or sufferings, peace or distress, health or illness, ask nothing, refuse nothing, but always be ready to do and to suffer anything that comes from His providence. Perhaps her greatest gift happened one Sunday in the choir when the community was reciting Deus Caritas Est, God is love. She was overcome with an understanding of these words as though they were a new revelation to her, and these words were constantly on her lips, in her mind and in her heart, even encouraging all of us to remember God is love. Teresa Margaret was caring for an elderly nun by the name of Sister Adelaide, and she made a pact with her. It was obvious that Sister Adelaide was not long for this world, and the pact was that when Sister Adelaide died and stood before the throne of God, she would ask God to permit Sister Teresa Margaret to join her soon so that Teresa Margaret may love Him without hindrance for all eternity in His presence. Well, Sister Adelaide did pass away, and within a very short time, Teresa Margaret, who was full of vitality, health, and energy, suffered from what has been suspected as a strangulated hernia and was taken to the infirmary in severe pain. They were not too concerned, but when the doctor returned the following morning, he found all her organs were shutting down. She held the crucifix in her hand, pressing her lips to the 5 wounds of Christ. Well, the nuns gathered around as her soul took flight to heaven. She was just 22 years old. But the story doesn't end there. As the sisters pulled back the covers, they discovered her hands and feet were almost black, and the whole body appeared to be decomposing. It was decided that she should be prepared immediately for burial. Her face had darkened, and she was difficult to recognize. The next day, the ceremony was held and the body was being taken to the crypt, but Almighty God would have the last word. They noticed a change taking place, and within a few hours, the face, the hands, and the feet had regained their natural color. Her face appeared healthy and lifelike as though she was only sleeping. And then an unbelievable aroma of sweet fragrance was noticed by everyone in the room, and the fragrance grew in intensity. Her body became so beautiful and lifelike that a painter was summoned to paint her portrait. Doctors, priests, sisters, they all examined her body and declared it appeared just as a child who was sleeping. And today that incorrupt body still remains in the nuns' choir in the Carmel of Florence. On March 19th, 1934, Pope Pius XI entered the name of Blessed Teresa Margaret to the Register of Saints. Her life shows that serving God can create wonders with just small steps, and it is just the little things that count. And too often we mortals forget that it is truly in the small activities of daily lives that we can serve God by love. I'd like to close today with a short example from the bulletin of the Immaculate Heart of Mary Parish in Los Alamos, New Mexico, with just a story that illustrates that point. It says that Andrew was born with mild Down syndrome. He loved to go to religious class after Mass on Sunday, and there were 9 other children there who learned, laughed, and played together. But Andrew was never really part of the group. He didn't choose to be different, he just was, and his classmates mostly just ignored him. They weren't unkind, they just ignored him. They were children. On the first Sunday after Easter, the teacher arrived with 10 of those little plastic eggs that often open up, and she gave each one to a child, and they were to go out and find symbols of new life to put into their eggs at a springtime. Well, the children ran out gathering the little finds and brought their treasures back inside, and then the children gathered around the teacher and opened the first egg, which held a little flower. And of course they oohed and aahed, and they opened another, and there was a little butterfly. And in the third there was a fresh green leaf. But the fourth egg had nothing inside. Well, the children, as 8 and 9 years old will do, said, "That's stupid, and somebody didn't do it right," and so on. And then the teacher felt a tug on their sleeve, and she looked down, and it was Andrew said, "It's mine." Someone said, "You never do anything right, Andrew. There's nothing there." And Andrew replied, "I did so do it right. The tomb is empty." There was sudden silence, and then someone said, "Neat. Well, right on." And from that moment on, Andrew became a part of the group. He was set free. It was because of something small, something little, and he was set free completely from that tomb of indifference. Well, Andrew died later that summer from an infection that most children could have shrugged off. And God is often served best by little things that to him are very large. At his funeral mass, 9 8-year-old children, together with their teacher, marched up to the altar, not with flowers as a remembrance, but with an empty egg, and placed it on the altar steps. The tomb is empty. It is the small things that we do that counts. This is Tom Shrewsbury with Reflections for the Covenant Network.